This is 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Koval Anderson. Welcome to My Happy Place, my podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can buy me a coffee. Check out my page at buymeacoffee.com/Michael. That's M-I-K-A-E-L. 2020, what a crazy year for everybody. I read an article recently about how the number of people listening to podcasts has plummeted this year. This is largely because many people listen to podcasts on their commute, either in a car or on public transport. And with everybody working from home around the world, I guess they're finding other things to do. Yeah, so here's me showing how media savvy I am and launching a podcast in late 2020. Now, if you've been listening to this podcast, you figured out that it is a bit of a personal journey for me. But it is my hope that by compiling a list of the 100 things I will miss when I'm dead, it will get other people thinking about what simple pleasures they will miss. In a crazy, messed up macro world, which we have little control over, it really is the micro pleasures that matter the most, now more than ever. In a normal year, I am in another place than my own city of Copenhagen half the time, traveling for work. I had a flurry of traveling at the beginning of 2020, right up until the lockdown. Since then, I only went on summer holidays. So for a person who thrives on traveling, on departing and arriving, on crossing borders, 2020 really sucks. Which is maybe why I ended up going a little bit overboard with this episode. It started out simple, but it ended up snowballing into something uncontrollable. So while I got a little bit carried away, it is my hope that I can carry you away as well. Let's do it. Episode 4. Number 25, crossing borders. Let me get a disclaimer out of the way right here at the beginning. I am not a big fan of the concept of borders. For the vast majority of the 200,000 years Homo sapiens have been around, there were no defined lines separating peoples. Our nomadic forefathers enjoyed the freedom of the terrain, and while later there were territorial boundaries and regions, they were blurry. The agricultural revolution, a mere 10 or 12,000 years ago, changed all of that, as well as many other things, most of it not for the betterment of human society. We evolved into a species hell-bent on territory, fences, walls, armies to defend them. Even in ancient Greece, the Delphic priestesses regarded the right of unrestricted movement as one of the four freedoms separating liberty from slavery. New arrivals were often regarded as an asset instead of a problem. They would contribute to a region's wealth, pay taxes, and serve in local armies. Times have changed. The oldest national border is the 120 kilometers around Andorra, nestled in the Pyrenees between France and Spain. It dates to September 8, 1278. A young whippersnapper of only 742 years, which is only 0.371% of the time Homo sapiens have been around. Passports? They're only just a century old in their current form. End disclaimer. With all that said, I am going to miss crossing borders. It's an event that feels important, even if it is a constructed importance born of nationalism. It has a weird mix of somber and exciting. The seriousness of standing in line, the nervosity. Don't we all just feel like a drug runner who has swallowed a condom filled with cocaine when we walk up to the counter? Even if we're just on our way to Disney World with the family? And then the relief when the rubber stamp falls onto the paper of our passport and is handed back. I just sat down with a coffee and looked through all of my passports, current and expired. 7 in all. On the one hand, the passport stamps are just like blotches of animal urine squirted on paper to mark a territory. But on the other, they're cool. Of course they're cool. An inky roadmap of places we've been, complete with dates of arrival and departure. Here's a little design observation. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, many of the stamps I have in my passports were full-page affairs. A country saying, look at us and how important we are and be grateful that we granted you permission to enter us. Already by the mid to late 90s, the size seems to have been standardized to around 4.5 centimeters by 3 centimeters, which allows for about 6 stamps per page. All of those huge, pompous rubber stamps have now been replaced by surly border guards who try to make you feel like a criminal. I like to try and make a game of it. I try to make them smile. What's the purpose of your visit to the United States of America? Yeah, I'm speaking at an architectural conference. You cue his eyes narrowing in suspicion. Will you be receiving payment for that? You know what, dude? I'm just hoping someone will buy me a beer when I'm done. You know what I'm saying? Boom. Deflection. Icebreaker. Smile. Good luck with that, sir. Enjoy your stay. Or arriving in Beirut and walking up to a border guard looking like he was in the foulest of moods. Hey, you know what? You guys have the coolest uniforms of any border police in the world. Seriously, man. Click. Big smile. You think so? I think they're pretty nice. They're actually new. We got them last year, and so on. It doesn't work every single time, but it's always fun to try. But I digress. At the core, passport stamps and border crossings possess an inherently romantic and adventurous air. Back in the day, crossing back and forth between the U.S. and Canada was rather uneventful. Before 9/11, you just showed a driving license and answered a couple of vague questions. So crossing that border countless times isn't really memorable at all. But apart from that, I remember my first international border crossing very clearly. At the age of 19, I attended theater school in Los Angeles. That city was a big, bad, exciting world when you just arrived from a mundane Canadian city on the prairies. But just there, across the Mexican border, was a place of epic infamy. One day, my friend and roommate, he was the guy who had the car too, he said, "Hey, we could go to Tijuana for the day." And I'm like, "What? Can we?" Of course we can. The realization that we could do whatever we wanted was thrilling. We were wet behind the ears adults, but damn, we were adults. Tijuana's painted face and toothless smile was as seductive as it was scary and arousing. It was the first chaotic city I had experienced without adult supervision. I had left the bosom of everything comfortable behind me. I could cross an international border at will, and into a cauldron of everything that decent parents had tried to protect me from. The long, hot wait at the border south of San Diego was a teaser. Beyond lay decaying, potholed streets. Gone was the familiar grid system layout of the overplanned cities to the north. Adding that disorientation to the fear and excitement was a whiskey chaser after a bucket of beer. A curious young man from a dull, white suburban world unleashed himself, unchaperoned, into a thrilling urban chaos. I still wonder how Tijuana subliminally influenced the trajectories that my life took ever since. I may never know. The sensory orgy of the place, however, still scents my skin, arouses my mind, and colors my imagination. That was my first proper border crossing. And what a way to kick it off. Then there's the longest. I landed in Sao Paulo on a flight from Frankfurt on my first visit to Brazil for work. When I handed my passport to the passport officer, who was a young man in his early 20s in casual clothes and with an earbud in one ear playing music, he flipped through the pages and then he looked at me and said, "But where's your visa?" Oh, no. For all my traveling, I had forgotten to even check if I needed a visa for Brazil. They checked my passport before boarding in Frankfurt and they should have stopped me there. But here I was. He called over a colleague and, "Yep, you have to go back on the next flight." There was no discussion. I was directed to a bench nearby and promptly forgotten. I was a guest of the city of Sao Paulo on that trip, and I called my contact there who was waiting to pick me up on the other side of baggage control. He said that there was a temporary visa, and he told me to sit tight while he figured out how to get one through his channels. I sat tight. In situations like that, you are normally put on the same plane that brought you there. Mine wasn't doing a quick turnaround, so I sat tight for 10 hours. No baggage, freezing in the air conditioning, no food or drink offered, nobody telling me anything. I was persona non grata. The temporary visa approval took the whole 10 hours as well. It came through as I was about to be led to the plane to board, right at the last possible minute. It was so crazy. Before that happened, all I had to do was stare at the ebb and flow of the passport lines as flight after flight arrived from faraway places. A few thousand tired travelers shuffling along in zigzagging lines. The click-clacking of rolling luggage on tiles. The sound of bags being pushed along the floor with feet. The constant dull thumping of rubber stamps. The low murmur of passengers in dozens of languages. Expectant visitors were excited about arriving, and Brazilians were returning home. I watched the staff keep changing the shape and length of the lines as they extended and shortened the jigsaw puzzle of retractable nylon belt barriers. A handful of other people were refused entry and led away. There can't be many people who have studied a passport area in an airport for 10 hours, whether they had no choice or they did it on purpose. This subject has really led me down memory lane. It's caused me to embark on many a displacement activity, looking through old passports and scrolling through photos. It also made me think about the coolest border crossings I've done. Apart from Tijuana, here they come. I was the sickest I had ever been in my life. Never been close before or since. I never figured out what I had, but it was more than a week of high fever, hallucinations, and the wildest diarrhea. Oh, and by the way, I was stuck in the town of Kashgar, in the Xinjiang region in the far west of China, having traveled 3 days by bus along gravel roads across the driest desert on Earth. There weren't many travelers back then in that part of the world, but luckily, I was sharing a room in a dull concrete hostel with a backpacking British doctor. He ended up caring for me. Getting better was important, but I also had a pressing deadline. I was heading south to Pakistan. The problem was that it was November, and the road could close for the winter any day, without warning. If it closed, I would have to head back across the desert and go instead to Beijing or Hong Kong, a minor detour of about 4,000 kilometers. I was on the mend, but I was weakened from not having eaten for more than a week, and I had to gather all my strength and get moving. I boarded a bus packed with Pakistani traders, all heading home with great bundles of goods strapped to the roof. And off we went, rumbling along one of the world's highest paved roads, the Karakoram Highway, stretching 1,300 kilometers through China and Pakistan. We were heading towards the Karakoram Mountains, the second highest mountain range in the world, and, more specifically, the world's highest international border crossing at the Kunjarab Pass. Altitude, 4,693 meters. I spent hours at that border, located on a barren, windswept plain, first on the Chinese side and then the Pakistani. All the other passengers had to declare their goods, and the paperwork was epic, as was the unwritten system of traders bribing authorities on the Pakistani side. It was fascinating to watch. The Chinese soldiers took one look at me and said one word, one of the few words they knew in English. Coins? I was prepared for this. I always had a bag of coins when traveling in China. I was there in a period where there weren't many Chinese coins in circulation. Most of the currency was paper, which made many a Chinese avid coin collectors. So I spent an hour at the counter with my collection of European coins spilled out and a gaggle of Chinese soldiers discussing them at length. I gave them away to the soldiers, but it required diplomacy to make sure they were evenly distributed. I also passed some time in the foreigners' reading and resting room, essentially a yurt-like tent, but a cozy touch in that bizarre location, before the bus was ready to head south along one of the most dangerous highways on the planet. There was tension at that border, but little pomp and circumstance, unlike another border crossing involving China just a month before. I took a train from Kazakhstan to Urumqi in western China. A year before, the Soviet Union had dissolved. The train was filled with Kazakhs and other passengers from all over Central Asia. Most were heading to China to sell and buy goods. There was an amazing spirit on that train. For the first time in 70 years, international border crossings were allowed, and the passengers were making the most of it. It was festive. We arrived at night, first stopping on the Kazakh side of the border. I had traveled extensively in the Soviet Union, and the borders were serious affairs. Not anymore. It was casual and relaxed. The two countries used a different rail gauge, so car by car, the train was lifted up on huge cranes as all the wheel sets were swapped for the Chinese size. We then moved in the dark from one puddle of bright light to another, 12 kilometers down the track, at some point in the inky night, passing the actual Chinese border, before arriving at the Chinese border crossing and railhead. It was brand new. You suspected the packing crates were hidden behind the smart painted buildings facing the tracks. Patriotic slogans on cloth banners lined the fences on our approach. Under the blinding floodlights, we were surrounded by soldiers spaced about 10 meters apart, all of them armed with shiny black machine guns. Here it was evident that somebody still thought rather highly of themselves as a superpower. All manner of officials paraded around both inside and outside the train. Scores of people in uniform flowed past, shouting at each other and trying to look important. What all their job descriptions were beyond me. It was bureaucracy meets show of force. The highest-ranking officials were comical. They wore long overcoats with fur-lined collars draped cockily over their shoulders. Their military hats sat jauntily on the side of their head. Leather jackboots crunched ominously with every step. They all smoked, and the high-ranking officials, and only them, held their cigarettes with their palm facing upwards. Whoever designed the uniforms and the attitude had clearly seen many Nazi propaganda films. My fellow passengers were not at all intimidated. They had recently witnessed firsthand the decline that has hunted down every powerful empire in history, and that clearly made them skeptical about the future of a nation that still pretends. Once we were ready to get underway, an announcement blared over the public address system in Mandarin and Russian. The tension that hung in the air like the smoke of a rancid Chinese cigarette had faded, and the passengers were in even higher spirits. I think everyone had felt the same way about all the peacocking nonsense. For some reason, the female announcer's Russian pronunciation of goodbye, which is «до свидания», and she said something like «до свидания», caused almost everyone in the car, and no doubt the entire train, to explode into fits of laughter. People repeated it in unflattering imitations, and that set everyone off again, hooting wildly. It was the most impressive bout of public laughter I have ever enjoyed. The loudspeakers on the platform were cranked up high to blare twanging Chinese patriotic songs that filled the cold air as the train pulled away from the station, and soon we were in the black of the night once again. But we were on our way. Then there was the time I was wandering around the harbor in Baku, Azerbaijan, looking for a ride across the Caspian Sea. You know, as you do. There were rumors of a ferry, but I couldn't find it or any information about it. The most precise info I got was, maybe next week. That wasn't going to work for me at all. If I couldn't get across the Caspian Sea, I would have to do a massive detour, going all the way back to Moscow in order to get over to Central Asia. I couldn't go south and loop around the bottom because that would take me through Iran, and I wasn't visa'd up for that. So there I was, wandering around the harbor asking weathered, suspicious sailors where there was a boat that could take me on board. I was absolutely an oddity in those parts at that time. I was 24 years old, but I looked 16. I spoke Russian with an accent and was far from fluent. Many people on that trip asked me where my parents were and were skeptical when I said that I was a journalist living in London. At the beginning of this journey, back in Warsaw, I prepared as best as I could. I kitted myself out with the most Eastern European clothes I could find at local markets, as well as a local backpack, all in order to travel as incognito as possible. Down through Ukraine, through the Caucasus and the new countries in Central Asia, on my way to China, Pakistan, and India. At the Russian tourist office in Warsaw, I bribed myself to a visa that would have been impossible for the previous 70 years. It cost me $70. As was the case during the Soviet Union, foreigners were not allowed to travel in second or third class on the trains. But that's exactly where I wanted to be. I wanted to meet the regular citizens of all these places now that the Soviet Union had collapsed. I had many books with me to read on my journey, and there was one detail about my being incognito that I missed. I met an English teacher on a train in Ukraine, in a third-class compartment. She noticed that I was reading a book in English and started talking to me in English. I explained my trip to her, and she immediately became worried for me in a friendly and motherly way. Yeah, the English book gave me away, and she suggested that I find a Russian book with a dust cover and use that on all of my English books. That was a great pro tip, and I did it as soon as I could. She was also worried about what would happen if I was caught traveling in second or third class, or in a more precarious situation. Her second pro tip? Just tell people you're from the Baltics. She explained that everyone in the Soviet Union, of course, knew the Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and that they spoke different languages up there, but they were small, weird places on the edge of the Soviet Empire, and not many people had interacted with them. Ya iz Balti, I am from the Baltics. She made me practice that phrase over and over again, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I'm grateful that she did, because it literally got me out of trouble about 10 times where I was about to have to show my passport, and then the game would be up. I was also the first Westerner everybody had ever met. Imagine the pressure of being the first contact with the entire Western world. The people that I ended up engaging in conversation, upon learning that I was from the West, always had so many questions. Not surprising after 70 years of Soviet propaganda and the Cold War narrative. I was expecting them to ask questions like, how many cars do you have? Or do you live in a mansion? And things like that. But you know what? Everywhere I went, it was much more simple. How much is a kilo of beef? What about potatoes? How much are 6 eggs? Can you travel anywhere? Have you been to Paris? Oh, tell me about Paris. What are your supermarkets like? Simple, everyday questions about life. I loved it. But back to the harbor. I wasn't having much luck in the industrial end of the harbor with the rusty ships of the oil industry, so I figured out where the fishermen were. I spent 3 days asking around, and it wasn't looking good. But persistence pays off. The fishermen started to recognize this weird-looking kid, and one of them grumbled, "Go talk to Vladimir. He's on the boat called Elena." I sought him out, and he was as skeptical as everyone else. Until I answered, "Yes, of course," to his question, "Do you have dollars?" I was wary about pulling out my cash at the end of a dock in Baku to prove it to him. But these were the early days after the decline of the Soviet Union, and it had yet to become a rough-and-tumble and highly criminalized world. All these former republics had become new nations, but it was still all very transitional, a kind of purgatory, a lot of, let's wait and see how this works out, back then in 1992. Now, I had no idea what the black market rate for sailing illegal foreigners across the Caspian Sea was, and I assumed that Vladimir was also new to this game. I showed him 5 $10 bills, and I could see in the barely perceptible twitches of his micro-expressions that he was amazed. But he played it cool. He nodded and said, "We leave tonight." For reference, a 3-day journey in a sleeping compartment on a train didn't cost more than the equivalent of about $3 back then. So $50 was a considerable amount. Vladimir also said, "Bring your own food and drink. I'm not a restaurant." I went back to my hotel, grabbed my backpack, and went to a supermarket to stock up on supplies before heading back to the harbor at dusk. Like in any small, tight-knit community, word travels fast, and as I was walking down the docks towards the boat, the other fishermen now nodded and mumbled pleasantries like, "Good luck," and "Have a good trip." Vladimir was ready, and without ceremony, he fired up the engine and we chugged out of the harbor as the sun was setting and Baku was silhouetted behind us. I gave him the 5 $10 bills right off the bat, and he just took one and studied both sides of it with curiosity. He pointed to the little stove and just said, "Coffee." I poured a cup of the thick, strong liquid and settled in for the journey. He was quite noncommittal when I asked how long the trip would take. He just shrugged. The destination was the city of Turkmenbashi in, not surprisingly, Turkmenistan. And I could see on a map that I had that the distance was about 300 kilometers. Elena was rough around the edges, and Vladimir clearly took good care of her, but she was a fishing boat and not built for speed. Vladimir was reluctant at first to engage in conversation, but he eventually opened up. He was Russian and had moved to Azerbaijan because he married an Azerbaijani woman. One of the amazing things about Russian/Soviet culture back then was that regardless of who you were speaking to, be it a doctor, shopkeeper, engineer, or fisherman, you could be sure to have conversations about Russian literature. I wasn't surprised at all to see that Vladimir had a collection of poems by Pushkin in his wheelhouse, and we discussed it at length. And, also typically, he completely destroyed me at chess several times. One thing concerned him, however, and that was what might happen when he sailed into the harbor in Turkmenbashi with a weird foreigner on board, as well as what the right time to arrive might be in this untried situation. We were about 20 hours into the trip and Turkmenistan was visible on the horizon, but Vladimir didn't want to arrive in the evening. He didn't want to explain why, either. Morning was best, he told me. Other fishing boats would be arriving that time. It's better, he said. So, we dropped anchor and waited. On the final approach the next morning, I could see that he was nervous, and I assured him that it would be okay if he just sailed up to a dock, I hopped off, and he headed home, as quick as possible. He really liked this idea, so that's exactly what we did. He found a spot as far from the central harbor area as possible. I thanked him, we shook hands, I hopped off, and he got the hell out of there. The fishermen on this side of the Caspian Sea were just as suspicious as I walked down the dock. But that didn't matter now. I just needed to arrive. There weren't yet proper border controls, as there probably are today, but there were always lots of undefined authorities to deal with. At the small office and checkpoint at the entrance to the harbor area, the guards or cops, or whatever they were pretty stunned when I presented them with my foreign passport. This was a situation where showing my documents wasn't a problem. They checked and double-checked my visa and asked how I got there. "With a friend," I said. I didn't want to say too much at all. I assured them that I would be taking the next train to Ashgabat, the capital. This was also a strategy that I employed in these parts. "Don't worry, I'm leaving. I will be someone else's problem very, very soon." They were pleased to hear that. And then they became curious and invited me to drink some tea with them as they bombarded me with questions about the West. It's not every day you get to drink tea with border guards in Turkmenistan, so of course I said yes. I was on a train to the capital later that afternoon. This next border crossing experience contrasts greatly with sipping tea in Turkmenbashi. It's hardly news that India and Pakistan are not the greatest fans of each other. It is one of the most volatile borders in the world, and it's in a constant state of change, depending on who pissed off who this month. I was in Pakistan, and I needed to get to India from the city of Lahore. But for a long while before I got there, freedom of movement across the border was heavily restricted due to, well, you know, politics. There was only a convoy of buses across the border, and it was tricky to get a seat. Luckily, I heard that the rail connection was going to open up again, and I went down to the station early in the morning in order to get a ticket, along with everyone else. It was absolutely packed, but I still managed to obtain a ticket for the train that day. The scheduled departure time was around noon, and the train was waiting at the station. I took my seat in the compartment and waited. A friendly family of five joined me at some point, and we agreed that the train probably wasn't going to leave on time, since it was the first train on this route for quite a while. Like most borders in that entire region, it's less about the people who need to cross it than all of the goods that they are transporting. For hours on end, large plastic bags and cardboard boxes were loaded onto the train. There was no glass in the window, but there were thick metal bars because of the high security nature of this route. As time passed, the corridor outside the compartment started to fill up with boxes and bags until, quite literally, they reached the roof. This entire train was stuffed like a sausage to the point of bursting. It's times like this where wondering what would happen if a fire broke out is not recommended. At no point throughout the day could anyone tell me when the train might depart. But the scenes outside the window were so fantastically cinematic that it didn't matter. It was in the early evening when the train lurched a bit. Cheers were heard up and down the platform. The mood was celebratory. The engine groaned to life and struggled to get the train rolling, so heavy as it was. But we rolled, ever so slowly. For all of the goods packed on the train and all the people hanging off the sides and sitting on the roof, it was a bit bizarre that we were only going to be traveling about 40 kilometers. As we laboriously creaked and groaned our way through the suburbs of Lahore, people were gathered along the tracks. This was an event. The border is heavily guarded, as you might expect, and this is one of the few holes in it. We were in the village of Wagha, near the so-called Radcliffe Line, the boundary that the British drew during the partition of India. The train thundered to a halt, and one of the most splendid and bizarre border ceremonies in the world began. Both nations had a massive iron gate across the train tracks. Regular servicemen manned the machine gun nests on both sides of the no man's land, faces grave and serious as they pointed huge weapons at each other. But both nations also have a military unit decked out in splendid ceremonial uniforms, more like costumes, really. And they performed a marching display that rivaled anything the animal kingdom can dish up with. Goose-stepping into the sky, grandiose staring each other down with the wildest macho and mustachioed glares. It was spectacular theater masking the seriousness of this dangerous boundary. There was some whooping and laughing from train passengers, but not that much. When the ceremony was finished, the train crawled through the no-man's land and the passengers were largely silent. The tension was as thick as molasses. We stared out the windows at the soldiers on both sides with their mean and serious facial expressions, fingers literally on the trigger of their machine guns. I've learned that since then, India and Pakistan have capitalized on the theatrical nature of the ceremony, building a mini stadium on either side of the border where spectators can watch the daily lowering of the flags ceremony. If you Google Wagha border, that's W-A-G-A-H, you can see the modern version for yourself in countless films and photos. On Google Earth, it looks like there's now a road built to replace the railway. Back then, it was fascinating, but also intense and nervous. We rolled on towards Amritsar in India. I changed trains for New Delhi. A few years later, I walked out of the train station in Figueres in northern Catalonia, starting a long 900-kilometer walk north to Paris, equipped only with a small backpack. That first day, I followed dirt roads through the vineyards in the foothills of the Pyrenees and up to the ridge of the mountain range. At the top, the path was narrow, but there were two stone markers. One had France carved into it. The other read España. It was almost completely dark. I had walked 30 kilometers that day, and my body ached. I rolled out my sleeping bag and slept on the ground with my head in France and my feet in Catalonia. That is my kind of border. Although, with all of this said, the only thing that concerns me with this podcast is the one hard, defined border between being alive and being quite dead. Until we cross that border, let's live a little more like our ancestors. I wrote and recorded these words in Copenhagen, but there are people listening to them in faraway places. They can also buy my books, written at the same table. They can see photographs taken outside my door. Thoughts and ideas know only the wind. Art is a raindrop that falls into lakes and then flows freely down rivers to the seas. We don't need borders. We need bridges. You've been listening to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. If you like the podcast, I would be thrilled if you wanted to buy me a coffee. You can check out how at buymeacoffee.com/Michael. That's M-I-K-A-E-L. The music I use is by Phil Creamer and Mikael Gjøll. Me? I'm Michael Koval Anderson. Catch you next time, and thanks for listening.